This is The Gay Life, KSAN's public affairs show for gentlemen who prefer gentlemen, for women who prefer women, and for people who prefer people. You don't have to be gay to listen. Good evening. I'm Randy Alfred. Tonight our discussion is on the new diseases, the so-called gay cancer. And later in the show we'll be talking to Bobby Campbell, a gay nurse in San Francisco who has the disease. But first our guests are Dr. Paul Wolberding and Dr. Marcus Conant, who are both associated with the University of California Medical School. Dr. Conant is a dermatologist. Dr. Wolberding is a cancer specialist. And they've both been dealing with it and are part of the special task force, which the city and the University of California Medical Center has set up to study this new and puzzling outbreak of a long-known disease. Good evening, Dr. Wolberding.
Hello.
And good evening, Dr. Conant.
Good evening, Ray.
Is the disease really a gay disease? Is it gay cancer?
Kaposi sarcoma is a tumor that's been recognized for somewhat over 100 years, and until recently, no one suspected any association with gays. It's only been in the last 1 or 2 years, really, that there's been an association seen with Kaposi sarcoma in the homosexual community. Before this time, it was regarded as a very rare disease in the United States and really only seen in elderly men.
And my personal prejudice is that it probably is not a gay disease. We have seen this outbreak of Kaposi sarcoma and pneumocystis pneumonia, as Paul said, in the last couple of years in the homosexual community. But recently the CDC has told us that there are now some 28 cases in heterosexual men and women. So I would believe that probably we're seeing this outbreak in a very sexually active group in the population, namely the gay community, and that we will see the disease in the heterosexual community as well in the next few months in greater numbers. Certainly, as far as we as scientists have been able to determine for many years, there is no scientific or physiological difference between homosexuals and heterosexuals. There's no gene that makes you gay. There's no hormone that makes you gay. The psychiatrists tell us that homosexuals appear to be as emotionally normal or abnormal, if you will, as the rest of the population. And so they've said that it's not an emotional disease. And so as far as we can tell, being gay does not set people apart from the rest of the society. And so at the present time, we can see no reason why this disease is attacking gays except for the fact that they are sexually far more active and may be being exposed to something more than the general population.
What are the sexual habits of the 28 known cases of Kaposi sarcoma among heterosexuals?
I don't know that, and it's an excellent question. Those cases are in the property of the CDC at the present time. They've been reported from various sources to the CDC. The only thing that I can give you is a breakdown on the cases. Of the 28 cases, 21 are in males and 7 are in females. All of the female cases have been pneumocystis, and most of the male cases have been pneumocystis pneumonia. 2 of them have been Kaposi sarcoma. We are told, and we do not have this verified yet, it has not been published, that many of these cases are heavy drug abusers and have used IV medications, suggesting perhaps introduction of some agent through that source.
You've mentioned pneumocystis, which is, in fact, not a cancer but a form of pneumonia.
That's correct.
What causes the form of pneumonia? Do we know more about that than we know about the cancer?
We don't know a great deal about either one. Pneumocystis is an organism that gets in the lung, and it's considered generally an opportunistic infection. It's an infection that usually attacks people whose bodies are run down, who are immunocompromised, whose immune systems are not functioning as they should. And the disease has been known for years. It's been seen for years in immunocompromised individuals. What's new here is the sudden appearance of pneumocystis pneumonia in apparently previously healthy individuals who, it later was learned, were gay. And many of the initial cases were not diagnosed until the disease had already progressed to to a far point, and many of them died. Of the cases that have been seen so far, the CDC now tells us that there have been about 200 cases of this outbreak that we're talking about. About 60% of the cases have been pneumocystis, and about 40% of the cases have been Kaposi sarcoma. Some of the patients have had both conditions. They have started with Kaposi's sarcoma and then developed pneumocystis pneumonia, and the reciprocal has been seen as well.
Is it clear then which causes which, or is there a causal relationship, or is it this got to do with the opportunistic nature?
It's probable that the underlying defect is the same in both conditions, that something is causing the immune system to be compromised, and that the deficiency in the immune system allows these persons to be infected by organisms that otherwise are only seen in people who are debilitated, and also to develop a malignancy that otherwise is very rare.
The pneumocystis virus is actually fairly common, isn't it? Not in terms of its infection in people, but it's present in the environment.
First of all, it's not a virus. It's a protozoa.
Oh, okay.
And it is extremely common. It's felt to be present everywhere.
So this would lead also to the idea that it's an immunosuppression, that most people are healthy enough not to get it normally.
Exactly.
Okay. That's right. What about the relationship of immunosuppression, though, to the development of a tumor?
Well, it's an interesting point, because Kaposi's sarcoma, although it's been rare in the past, one group that it's been seen in is patients who have been immunosuppressed for medical reasons, particularly people who have gotten kidney transplants, who take medications to prevent the rejection of the kidney. Those individuals have a higher incidence of Kaposi's sarcoma than the usual population.
Also, isn't the new form of Kaposi's sarcoma, or the new outbreak, a lot more virulent than traditional?
Yeah,
or the older cases that are in the medical journals?
We're used to thinking of Kaposi's sarcoma as a very indolent malignancy, a tumor that, again, usually seen in elderly men, and often can be present for 10, 15 years, and often the patients even haven't died of that, but of other illnesses. In this form that we're seeing now, we see a much more rapid course with early dissemination of the tumor involving many organs in addition to the skin.
There are a couple of other diseases that have been mentioned in connection with this whole outbreak. One of them is a form of tongue cancer. What's that about?
It's interesting because we discovered that case in the Kaposi Clinic at the University of California. A patient was referred to us who had Kaposi's sarcoma. He's a man in his mid-30s, and he brought with him his partner, who is a man of 29 years old. We decided that it would be wise to examine his lover as well as the patient, and upon examination of his friend, we found that he had a lump on the back of his tongue. Biopsy of that mass on the tongue showed that it was a squamous cell carcinoma. Now, squamous cell carcinoma in the mouth is very, very rare in individuals 29 years old. It's even rarer in individuals who do not smoke, and this man does not smoke and has not smoked. And so our fear is that he has contracted something from his partner that has immunosuppressed him and allowed this cancer, which normally does not develop in 29-year-old individuals, to present itself. He is currently being evaluated to check his immune system and see if we're seeing the same kind of deficiencies in his immune system that we're seeing in the patients with Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis pneumonia.
Now, we don't normally think of cancer as something that's a contagious disease, but what you're saying here is that there's some other agent that makes one susceptible to the cancer, perhaps.
Well, we don't know, Randy, and that's one of the questions. You're quite right that in human beings we have never been able to show that there is a cancer that is caused by a bacteria or a virus or some agent that's transmissible. Now, that's not true in lower forms of life. There's an avian leucosis that is a viral cancer transmitted among birds from one to another. One suggestion has been that the Kaposi's sarcoma that has been known for years to occur in Africa, in equatorial Africa, particularly in Uganda, occurs far more commonly than the kind of Kaposi's sarcoma that was known for years in Europe. As a matter of fact, Kaposi's sarcoma in this one very localized area in Africa accounts for about 10% of all of the deaths from cancer, so it's more common there. There has been a suggestion that that cancer may be associated with a very unusual virus that's a member of the herpes group of viruses known as cytomegalovirus. And so one of the suggestions has been that perhaps individuals are contracting cytomegalovirus, which is then in some way suppressing their immune system or, in fact, causing the Kaposi's sarcoma. Now, this is not a simple issue because individuals who are immunosuppressed for other reasons develop cytomegalovirus infections very commonly. So here we have a situation where we don't know which is coming first, the chicken or the egg. We don't know if they're getting cytomegaloviral infections, which are then setting them up for the immunosuppression and the pneumocystis pneumonia and the Kaposi's, or whether the thing that is immunosuppressing them is setting them up for infection with the cytomegaloviral infection.
Okay, now we're talking about a couple of hundred cases among several million gay men in the country. However, I read one place that cytomegalovirus is apparently very common among gay men. What was the do you know the figure on
well,
that?
Well, if you look at serologic evidence of CMV infection, cytomegalovirus infection, in the population as a whole, you can find evidence for previous infection in 50% of the population. In the gay population, especially in urban areas, that percentage increases to nearly 100%, somewhere around 95-98% of gay men have evidence of previous CMV infection.
What would a CMV infection be like?
Many of them are asymptomatic or are indistinguishable from any other viral infection. There's a form of CMV infection that's not very distinguishable from infectious mononucleosis, which is caused by a very similar virus.
What are the symptoms of Kaposi's sarcoma?
The Kaposi's sarcoma cases that we have seen, the early cases have started with little salmon pink to slightly reddish flat lesions anywhere on the body. It's most common to find them on the plantar surface of the foot, on the bottom of the foot, but we have seen them on the sides of the legs, on the sides of the arm, on the face, on the nose, on the chest, the back. And as I say, they are generally flat when they begin and salmon pink in color. Now, the lesions grow fairly rapidly. Many of the lesions have shown fairly rapid growth within a period of 2 to 5 months. The lesion begins to raise up and takes on a definite violaceous or purple hue. And purple is the magic word. The color appears to be purple in older lesions. In very old lesions, they may even appear to be brown. It's very difficult for them to be distinguished from a variety of other lesions that are common on the skin. There's a condition called a dermatofibroma, which is just an overgrowth of scar tissue, which occurs frequently from insect bites. The thing that should be of concern to your listeners is if they see a lesion on their body that is new to them and is growing, they should see their physician and ask that he biopsy the lesion and send it to someone who's had experience reading the dermatopathology of Kaposi's sarcoma.
Okay, what about pneumocystis pneumonia?
Pneumocystis pneumonia is seen in people who generally complain of a chronic cough. Unlike pneumocystis pneumonia in other immunocompromised patients, in the gay community, these cases have presented with a chronic history of a cough, often slowly progressing over the period of several weeks. Any chronic cough should be checked out within several weeks, I think.
Okay, and the tongue tumor is apparently very evident. It's a lump.
The tongue tumor is a lump. That's correct.
And people should, we hope, have learned from at least their high school health classes, if not elsewhere, that unusual lumps are one of the warning signs of large variety of cancers. This is The Gay Life on KSAN. We're talking to Dr. Marcus Conant and Dr. Paul Volberding of the University of California Medical School about the outbreaks of so-called gay cancer and gay pneumonia in gay men in New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles seem to be the bulk of
main
it.
Areas.
What are the treatments for someone who is, let's get a little bit of hope in here, for someone who does find the symptoms and finds them early and gets off to the doctor?
Well, Paul's a specialist on that. Let me kind of give you an overview and then let him comment in more detail about some of the specific agents. At the present time, there are a variety of different approaches being looked at by different groups all over the country, because obviously the ideal treatment would be to correct the defect that is causing the problem. Unhappily, at the present time, we are unaware of what that defect is. We don't know what the etiological agent is, what caused the problem. If it is a virus, then the treatment should be various forms of antiviral drugs. If it's because the immune system has failed, treatment should be directed towards stimulating that immune system. If it is just a cancer, treatment should be directed toward poisoning the cancer and removing that. And so all of these various treatments are being looked at by different groups. Interferon, which is an antiviral agent, is being looked at by one group. Cancer chemotherapy is being looked at by our group as well as others. Various things such as thymosin, which stimulate the immune system, are being looked at by our group as well as others. So there's a variety of different investigational work going on. Fortunately, the investigators in all of the groups are in touch with each other, often on a daily basis. And so we are trying to compare notes and decide, in the small group of patients, what appears to be the best treatment to give the patients remission from the disease. And maybe Paul would like to comment on the exact kind of chemotherapy agents that we use.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to separate out patients who have a minimal amount of disease of a slowly progressing nature from those who have a lot of tumor and rapid progression or tumor that involves vital organs. Certainly, I think for the group with large tumor mass with rapid progression, we don't have the luxury of waiting to evaluate more experimental therapies that we're interested in. In those patients, I think we have a clear reason to try the use of chemotherapy. Now, when we use chemotherapy, we realize that the toxicities are appreciable, but we've seen such a rapid progression in these patients that often it's better to put up with the toxicities from the chemotherapy than to experience the continual progression of the disease.
Lesser of two evils.
Lesser of two evils. Now, there is, as Mark said, a real interest in finding therapies that are less toxic than chemotherapy, and more importantly, I think, more specific for the cause of this cancer. We have the same hope with all cancers, but Kaposi sarcoma is one where there are so many clues being presented to us that we really are hopeful that we'll be able to identify some very basic defect in the immune system. And much of our study of the patients that we're seeing now is directed to try to find that defect. If we can find it, as Mark said again, hopefully we can correct that defect without damaging the rest of the system the way we often see with the use of chemotherapy.
Is this an unusually complex cancer research problem, or has all of cancer research gotten this complex with having to look at genetics and virus and immunosuppression and all of those?
I think this will be a model for other human malignancies.
This may prove within 2 or 3 years, particularly if we're lucky and can solve some of the questions that this fascinating thing is presenting to us. This may look amazingly simple compared to other cancers eventually. I mean, here we suddenly have the new appearance of a cancer, an outbreak, if you will, spreading rapidly through one group in the population with a variety of clues that it may be associated with a virus, that there may be certain genetic makeup in these individuals, that these individuals may well have had contact with each other. Of the first 40 cases reported from New York, 4 had been intimate with each other. We have 3 groups of lovers in San Francisco who all have evidence of immunosuppression. We have 1 case from Southern California whose nephew's lover in New York has Kaposi sarcoma. So there are strong suggestions that there may be a point source, that these cases may have had contact with each other. And one of the things that interests us as scientists is the fact that this may give us clues about a variety of different cancers if we can unravel this problem.
There's been the hope for a long time that we might uncover some connection between the immune system and the development of a number of common malignancies. Kaposi sarcoma is the clearest example of that, and the one that we really hope will allow us to make similar inferences with other cancers.
Okay, this is the silver lining, perhaps, in that there may be in this particular outbreak keys to the general problems about the nature of cancer and the nature of the immune system, I guess.
Precisely. Right.
The question is that a lot of us don't like being in an experimental group by virtue of our lifestyle. And we've said that it doesn't have something to do biologically with being gay, because nothing biological has been found that can be connected to that. If it's lifestyle connected, there are various things we can look at. I don't think it's something like brunch as a lifestyle element. It's probably got to do with drugs and or a high sexual velocity, let's say, not to use judgmental terms. What about drugs? I've heard both recreational drugs such as poppers or even marijuana or psychedelic drugs be mentioned, as well as medical drugs. That is, people suggesting that you can only use the antibiotics so many times before they turn off your immune system or turn it down, or specifically a drug called Flagyl, which is used for treating of intestinal parasites.
Well, Flagyl was one of the first suspects in the cause of this. It's a drug that does have many unpleasant side effects and has been used extensively in the gay community for the treatment of intestinal parasites.
Its use is stopping now that people are...
Right. In the initial CDC investigations of these cases, though, a number of the cases of Kaposi's and pneumocystis have had no exposure to Flagyl. So I think it's really safe to say that that drug by itself isn't the cause of this health problem.
What happens after you've had one treatment with tetracycline and one with penicillin and one with some other antibiotic each year on the average for 10 or 15 years, and you've had 45 therapeutic courses of antibiotics?
Well, one speculation of a cause is, as you say, repeated infections. One of the
Is it the repeated infections or the treatment for the infections that's doing it?
We obviously
don't know.
Enigmatic smiles all around.
Right. And you see, the difficulty is, while many of our patients tell us that, yes, one of our patients, for example, has had gonorrhea more than 40 times, okay, that may just be telling us that he is sexually extremely active and could be exposed to some other agent, in this case the agent causing the Kaposi's sarcoma. And it was not the gonorrhea 40 times or the treatment for gonorrhea 40 times. This is just another statement of his sexual activity. The thing that's interesting in this is that some of the patients, a small number, are not that sexually active. We have one young man who is in his early 20s who has only had one sexually transmitted disease on one occasion.
And one patient who has been relatively inactive for 3 years.
Precisely. So they're not all individuals who have had numerous sexually transmitted diseases or have been treated with a variety of drugs. So while we are still looking at those factors, I think on a scale of 1 to 10, we would put those factors down at the bottom and we would look at other factors as a better bet. Now, you ask about recreational drugs, and let's talk about those for a moment. First, we know that marijuana suppresses T cell function. It suppresses one arm of the immune system. Now, most sexually active people in this country use or have used marijuana, and the CDC actually looked at that, and they found there was very little difference between gays and straights when they asked, are you using or have you recently used marijuana? Both groups of sexually active young people do. There is a marked difference in the use of amyl nitrate. Gays, for reasons that are not completely clear, 95 to 100% use or have used amyl nitrate. Only 10% of sexually active heterosexuals use or have used amyl nitrate.
The use or have used doesn't strike me as particularly useful because a lot of people will try anything once or twice, find out if they like it. The question is what percentage of people regularly use it.
I think it's
much higher among the gay male community, and my own estimates would be probably about one-third to one-half of all gay males use it regularly, whatever regularly means, and maybe only 2 to 5% of heterosexuals use it regularly.
Yeah, right. And yet we still have no so this drug's been implicated, but it may simply be that that's only a reflection of the gay lifestyle and may not be actually related to the drug.
The number of venereal diseases that they've had.
Right. Precisely. That is, it's just another index of swinging. We could maybe we should come up with a swinger index that is neutral for sexual orientation.
That it could be right, and that's going to be hard to develop.
But. Yeah, it would be. And by the time it got developed, I'm sure that the oncologists and dermatologists will have the solution before the sociologists like myself.
We certainly have no data at this point, though the studies have not been done in great detail, to show that amyl nitrate is an immunosuppressive agent. And we have some of these patients who have not been heavy users of amyl nitrate. Again, the young man I mentioned in his early 20s tried it once, got a headache, has never tried it again. And it's been 2 or 3 years since he's used amyl nitrate.
But apart from the immunosuppression, there is some evidence that nitrites are mutagenic and possibly carcinogenic.
That's correct.
Which would seem to.
There's one study from Italy that shows that nitrites in bacteria can be mutagenic. That's correct.
And one theory has been that the gay community uses the inhaled nitrites in large volume containers, and that if these are allowed to sit on the shelf for a prolonged period of time, that we may see contamination with other carcinogenic compounds, or conversion of the nitrites to carcinogenic compounds.
And the nitrites, as I understand it, have been around since the early 60s, and this outbreak is something that's new that's happened in only the last 2 years.
Right. On the other hand, most agents, whether chemical or whatever, that are carcinogenic, tend to take a large number of years to build up.
But the argument against that in these patients is that some of these people are fairly young, in their early 20s, and have been leading an active gay life for really only a few years. We have to suspect, when we're seeing the sudden appearance of a new tumor and new opportunistic infections, and at the same time and in the same community see this development of lymph node enlargement, that there might well be some association between the two. We're just starting to study that, and at this time, we don't know of any firm data that would correlate.
Whether this represents the part of the iceberg that's underwater, and the Kaposi and the pneumocystis cases are the part of the iceberg above water, and they're all part and parcel of the same thing, we're not sure at this time.
That would seem to indicate to me that a possibility is that the suppression is the result of a burnout, that the lymph system and the immune system is operating at a high level for so long that it burns out, and that's the suppression.
Well, that's an interesting speculation, one that we've thought about some as well. It could be explained by the repeated exposure to infectious agents, so that if you were continually being reinfected with a variety of viruses and bacteria,
right, or continually were fighting it off, even if you didn't get the symptoms,
right.
What should one do? What's a prudent course for a quote-unquote reasonably active or moderately active, let's use a term that's an average gay man to do? Should he cut down on the number of his sexual partners?
Well, you know, that's a difficult question because obviously when we have so little data as we have, the answer has got to be broad and speculative. Yes, it would appear that if our hypothesis, or some of our hypotheses, are correct, that this may be related to a viral agent that is contracted through sexual activity, if the suggestion that it may have come from a point source and be something that is transmissible is correct, then individuals should reduce the number of sexual contacts they have. Individuals who are monogamous with having sexual contacts with just one individual would certainly be far less at risk for developing this than someone whose lifestyle is very promiscuous. Also, individuals who stay with the same sexual partners rather than having a variety of different sexual partners statistically would be at a less chance of contracting something if there is, in fact, something being transmitted in the society. However, at this point, we would say that probably good advice to individuals would be to cut down on the number of sexual contacts they're having. Now, one should also comment about the use of drugs. We know that marijuana is immunosuppressive, and so if individuals did wish to reduce their chances of compromising their immune system, perhaps they should consider reducing the frequency with which they use a drug that is known to be an immunosuppressive drug, namely marijuana. And so individuals who are in the habit of smoking two or three joints a day might be well advised to reduce that considerably.
Anything else by way of advice?
Well, it's hard, I think, to recommend a sweeping change in a lifestyle based on the fear of developing a tumor that even, as you said earlier, it is still very rare. And I think it's reasonable to be prudent. And if we can come up with some speculations about the cause of this that makes some sense, then I would recommend that, as Mark says, that be reflected in your lifestyle. I would be more inclined to decrease the use of the nitrates. I personally suspect that they're more implicated than marijuana, but again, we really don't know.
Okay, thank you very much for being our guests here tonight on The Gay Life, Dr. Paul Volberding and Dr. Marcus Conant of the University of California Medical School. Continuing our discussion of Kaposi's sarcoma, the so-called gay cancer, our next guest is Bobby Campbell, a registered nurse who has been diagnosed as having the disease and who has been writing a series of articles on his personal reactions and personal experience in The Sentinel. Good evening, Bobby.
Good evening, Randy.
First, I think it's very brave of you to be here publicly discussing a very private and life-central and life-threatening kind of situation. And I want to commend you and thank you for that.
Thank you for having me.
Why are you willing to do this?
Oh, gosh. Well, Randy, part of the way that I'm dealing with the particular situation that I'm in, which, as you say, is life-threatening and is critical, is by sort of reaching out and talking to as many people as I can about the position that I'm in. In this way, not only do I find personal support for myself, but I'm also able, I hope, to educate people in the gay community and also in the medical and health communities about Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis carinii pneumonia and the other so-called gay illnesses. A lot of people have given me support for being brave. I don't feel brave so much as maybe a show-off, I guess. But it's, I don't know, I feel comfortable in doing it. And as a healthcare professional and an articulate person, I have a story to tell, and I'm happy to do it.
Let's start the story at the beginning. How did you first even suspect that you might have this disease, that as a health professional, surely you had read of it?
As a matter of fact, I had not read of it. It's so rare that until 1981, it was mentioned in medical dermatology textbooks with one paragraph and sort of glossed over onto the next thing. The way that I personally came to find myself as a Kaposi's sarcoma patient was that in 1981, I had a series of illnesses that were rare and baffling. In February, I was diagnosed as having herpes zoster, also known as shingles, which had me in the hospital for 4 days and excruciatingly painful. Essentially, herpes zoster is like chickenpox. It just kind of comes back, usually when you're quite old. It was not clear why I had this illness, and I sort of never did find out why that came down now instead of when I was 50 or 60, as is usually the case. In the summertime of 1981, I found that I had a low white blood cell count, which is the main mechanism the body uses to fight off infection, and that never was explained either. I was off work for a couple months in each case with both of those illnesses. So that was sort of the background to my illness. In September of 1981, I went with my boyfriend on a trip down the California coast to Monterey and San Simeon and so forth. As part of our trip, we went hiking in the Pinnacles National Monument near Hollister and went through some pretty rugged territory. And when I returned from this trip, I took off my hiking boots and found on the soles of my feet, right on the weight-bearing part, I had on each foot kind of a quarter-size purplish area, painless, that looked for all the world like blood blisters. And since I'd just been hiking, as I say, I didn't pay really any attention to it. And I just sort of ignored it for a little while. I showed my boyfriend, Ron, who is a doctor, and he just sort of glossed over it too at the time. When they stayed there for 2 or 3 weeks, I began to get a little worried. I'd been reading at that time in the Straight Press about these series of baffling illnesses that had been striking relatively healthy homosexual men nationwide. And when I mentioned as much to my boyfriend, he said, "Oh, well, you know, Kaposi's does appear on the feet and legs." I said, "Feet and legs?"
Okay, let's stop right there.
Okay.
That's the first point at which someone said you had a cancer symptom.
Yeah.
How did you feel?
It can't be me. I can't have this. It's not this. It's just a blood blister. It's something else.
So denial even before fright, or denial coming from fright? Or, I mean...
Gee, I don't
denial know. Was your reaction. How did you feel? I mean, what...
Well, I was scared. I don't want to have... I didn't then and don't now want to have cancer, but I do. And also, in a peculiar way, it was a sense of relief. It was a sense of being able to finally make sense of the illnesses that I had had in 1981. At least it made sense. It's better to have the awful truth in some ways than to have a confusing lack of, I don't know, to not know what it was.
So
my basic sense, though, was being scared, yeah.
Okay. And because of the other illnesses that you described previously, both of which would be consistent with the onset of a cancer, even before you went through the diagnostic process, then you must have had some sense of likelihood or even surety that that is what they would diagnose you as.
Well, there certainly was a likelihood. When I showed the lesions on my feet, the purple spots, to my boyfriend, who is a doctor, he said, "Oh, I'm sure it's not that. I'm sure it's not Kaposi's." And I went. I am a student at the University of California at San Francisco, and as such, I have health care through the student health service there. And I went to the internist, the regular doctor there, and she had never seen a case of Kaposi's. And she said, "Well, I've never seen one, and I'm sure it's not that. But just to relieve your anxiety, we'll refer you to Dr. Conant, who is head of the task force on Kaposi's." So all that time, up until I walked into Dr. Conant's office, I really believed that I did not have it, that some magical thing was going to come through, and that it wasn't going to be this. It was going to be something else. It was going to be a blood blister or some kind of, I don't know, just some other thing.
What did Dr. Conant say when he first examined you?
The first thing Dr. Conant said, he looked at my feet and he pointed out to his office nurse that there was a white halo around the lesions, that there was an area of blanching. And he pointed out this white halo to his nurse. And I guess overhearing this comment was the first real clue that, in fact, what I did have was Kaposi's sarcoma. And my heart sank. That was the first realization that I certainly did indeed have this cancer.
So then they had to do a biopsy.
Right. The way basically that Kaposi's sarcoma is diagnosed is by a biopsy, the removal of living tissue for examination under a microscope. There is no blood test per se under which it can be diagnosed. There's no real other manifestation. They have to take out a tiny piece of the lesion itself, or else of the lymph nodes surrounding the area. So Dr. Conant did do a biopsy of one of my foot lesions. And
that's done under a local anesthetic?
Right. And the local anesthetic hurt much more than the biopsy did. And then Dr. Conant was away for a week doing a presentation on Kaposi's. And when he came back a week later, I called him up. And over the phone, he told me the biopsy was positive. And my heart sunk still further. And it just confirmed what I had, by that point, pretty strongly suspected.
When he told you that you had cancer, did he tell you what your treatment options were going to be?
Yes. When I first went in to see Dr. Conant and he looked at them for the first time, he took about an hour off from a real busy practice to talk to me, to explain what the disease was, what the prognosis was, what the treatment options were. So I already knew pretty much what was in store for
me. Also, he knew he was not dealing with someone who was naive to the situation, that you are a registered nurse, that you are studying to be an adult nurse practitioner. What is the term again?
Adult health nurse practitioner.
Adult health nurse practitioner, that you are interested in health education as well, so that you're not the ordinary patient.
No, interestingly enough, Randy, not only am I interested in adult health nurse practitioner, but my specific focus is gay health care. So that hearing about the so-called gay cancers and gay pneumonias was right up my alley. I just wasn't expecting to be in the alley at the time when the truck came through. But I was. Yes, Conant knew that I was somewhat more informed than maybe the average Joe. He was real good. He spent a lot of time with me, as I say, explained the treatment options to me even before the diagnosis had come back, so that when he told me that the biopsy was positive, I knew pretty much where I stood.
Good. As he explained in the first part of this show, the method of treatment used depends on what stage the disease has advanced to or not advanced to, and what they can tell about the general state of your immune system and how healthy you are in general. So you had to go through further tests before they could even begin treatment then.
Boy, I certainly did. I went through about 3 weeks of pretty extensive tests in which they looked in every nook and cranny. They did a lot of blood work to determine what my immune status was. The main concern with Kaposi's is that it can spread to the gastrointestinal tract. And so in order to determine whether or not that was my case, they did endoscopies and a colonoscopy in which they insert a little fiber optic tube into your gastrointestinal tract through the mouth and through the rectum to visualize the tract, see what it looks like, and to see whether they can see any lesions. And if any lesions are present, they do a biopsy there. In fact, I did not have any, which was a big relief to me. They also did an X-ray to see whether I had pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, the pneumonia which often accompanies Kaposi's. They did,
and which even when it doesn't is actually more fatal statistically
yes,
than Kaposi's.
Yes, the Center for Disease Control has found that the pneumocystis carinii pneumonia or PCP is more hazardous to the patients who get it than is Kaposi's. And unfortunately, many patients develop both. Part of the problem is that you can be cured of the PCP and only to get it again and again and again. But I didn't have it, which is a big break for me. They also did an abdominal CAT scan, which is one of modern medicine's most expensive diagnostic tests, to see whether I had any lesions in my abdominal cavity, and I didn't. I was real lucky in that so far the purple spots, which the doctors call lesions, have only been found on my feet and one in my arm and possibly one in my mouth.
Okay. During this 3 week period approximately, when you were going through other tests, you were getting little bits of good news all along, but
right.
you still had the big bad news
right.
to deal with.
Uh-huh.
How did your feelings operate? Who were you sharing news, information, and feelings with?
Pretty much anybody who would stand still long enough to listen to me.
You've never been a closet cancer patient.
No, I've never been a closet cancer patient. I tend to be very disclosing in the things that happen to me. In part, that is adaptive for me because people who are my friends can then give me support. I had some quite outrageous experiences in which someone would just casually ask me, you know, gee, what's new? And I'd say, oh, I have cancer. And the person's face would drop. This was at the elevator at work. I called my parents. That was kind of a heavy-duty experience in itself, and they were very supportive after being initially shocked. I spoke to...
You've compared that to coming out of the closet about being gay.
Yes, I did in the latest column that I wrote for the Sentinel. There are a lot of similarities between having cancer and being gay in that both of them are stigmatized social positions. Both are kind of minority positions. And there's something, it's something that you can hide. Most gay people can choose to be overtly gay or not, and most people with cancer can choose to be overtly cancer patients or not.
Some of that gets carried right through to obituaries, where you still don't see, in most cases, the word cancer. People will say he died of a long illness, and you're supposed
right.
to know that that's code for, usually, code
right.
for that. And I don't know, there are very few newspapers that will even print the word, even if people want it that way.
Well, that's true. There's quite a social stigma attached to the word cancer. I was reading in a newspaper, a magazine lately, that the Environmental Protection Agency does not like the word carcinogenic, and they've sort of struck it from, and this is the EPA, has struck the word carcinogenic from their press releases and stuff. I opted for another course. I just thought that the more I talked about it, the better it would be for me and the better it would be for other people in my community. One of the points that I've tried to make is that I really feel very fortunate in some ways in that I have a lover who cares for me. I have a real good health insurance. I have a job situation which is very supportive. I can be on medical leave of absence. I have a lot of things going for me. And I'm worried about someone who may develop this disease and yet not have those pluses, who may have purple spots on his legs or feet or anywhere and not pay any attention to them, who 6 months from now, when he finally drags himself to a doctor, will be diagnosed and will not have a support system, will not have
a job. Have 6 months in which the disease need not have spread.
Right, right. So hopefully in my being a blabbermouth in this way has some payoff for this hypothetical person on Castro Street or Santa Monica Boulevard or whatever, who may read about this. And in fact, as a result of the articles that I've written for the Sentinel and other media stuff that I've done, I've had a number of phone calls and letters to people from people who expressed their concerns about various health problems that they've had, and also people who just wrote to thank me for what I was doing. It is my understanding that there is one patient who has gone to Dr. Conant and who was diagnosed as having Kaposi's, and he did so as a result of having read something that I'd written. And basically, the feeling that I may have saved somebody several months of being undiagnosed and having that spread to whatever, that alone makes this whole trip worthwhile to me.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN in San Francisco. We're talking to Bobby Campbell, registered nurse, about his own courageous fight against Kaposi's sarcoma. All right, you finally knew you had the disease, you knew that it was limited, and they picked out a course of therapy for you. What happened? What form of therapy are you on?
Well, Randy, there are a number of different types of therapy that can be applied. Originally, Kaposi's was treated with radiation. The type that is being used lately consists of chemotherapy. In other words, drugs are injected into the vein. Which type is used depends on how extensive the disease is and what the patient's history is. For me, they're using a drug called vinblastine. It's basically made from the periwinkle plant. The way that this drug acts is to kill cells that divide rapidly. It basically interferes with the dividing process itself. And since cancerous cells divide rapidly, the drug acts on them, and they start to divide, and they're offed by this drug. As it happens, a number of other cells also divide rapidly, such as hair follicle cells and bone marrow cells and the cells that line one's stomach and intestinal tract. So those cells also are at risk for being killed. What this means is that to take this drug, I'm also setting myself up for the possibility of becoming nauseated or having my hair fall out or reducing production in my bone marrow of my red cells, which carry oxygen to the body, and my white cells, which help to fight infection. And that was a risk I said I was willing to take. Some of the patients have said, evidently, to the doctors, you can do anything you want, but don't make my hair fall out. Because I've had everything from a crew cut to hair to my shoulders to a permanent to everything else, my hair was not important, and I told my boyfriend that if my hair started to fall out, I'd just shave my head and be a Folsom Street clone for a while. My hair was not as important as my life, and I wanted to take care of that. What I do is go in each week to the...
Have you had any of those side effects?
I have not had any nausea. I've not had any hair loss. I do have some impairment of my bone marrow production. My white cell count is low now. As I mentioned earlier, it was low over the summer, so it's not clear whether that's due to the medicine or due to some process happening in my body not relating to the chemotherapy itself. Basically, the particular drug that I'm taking, vinblastine, its main action is on the bone marrow. So the doctors are not looking for nausea or hair loss or those kind of things. What they would be looking for would be a low white cell count. And in fact, I've had that 1 week my white cell count was too low to give me the medicine. If your white cell count drops very low, one is at risk for any infection that comes along. And it's important to protect me from just any opportunistic infection that might be around. Every Monday I go to University of California, and first I have some blood drawn in which they check the sample for how many red cells and how many white cells and so forth are present. Then I talk to my oncologist, the cancer specialist, and he checks my blood count, and depending on what my white cell count is, he decides whether or not to give me vinblastine and how much of it to do. What that consists of is that the nurse starts an intravenous line, which is a needle into the vein, and the drug is injected, and then it's flushed with a saline solution. And then the needle is withdrawn, and I go my merry way.
How long does that take?
Oh, it could take 5 minutes if they just did it boom, boom. The first time that I had it, the next day I had a red streak running up my arm, which I called the nurse sort of in a panic, and she said, oh, your vein lit up. I felt like a neon sign on Broadway. So she said, from now on, we'll just have to flush it with more of a saline solution. So for me, it takes about half an hour. I just lay back and the IV drips in. And then when it's all done, they take out the needle and I go away. Nothing hurts. The only thing that ever hurts is when they stick me to draw blood or to start the IV to give me the medicine. It doesn't make me nauseated. As I say, I haven't had any hair loss. And I feel very positive about the chemotherapy. Many people who are on chemotherapy have a negative view of their chemotherapy. And I think that some work that has been done recently, especially in San Antonio, Texas, and other places, make it clear that cancer is real closely related to one's mental status. And it may very well be that people bring on cancers by their mental attitude, that there's a certain type of personality which is associated with a predisposition to get cancer. And that once a person has cancer, that you can either give up and die, quite literally. People who adopt kind of a defeatist attitude are more prone to have widespread metastases or spread of their cancer, and they're more likely to die quicker. Whereas people who have more of a fighting attitude, who believe that they're going to lick it, do, in fact, much more commonly. And one of the ways to do that is through techniques known as visualization, which you imagine the chemotherapy as sort of like little Pac-Man eating up the cancer cells and flushing them out. And I've tried to have, well, I have a real positive attitude toward my chemotherapy. One week when I was not allowed to have it because my white count was too low, I really felt cheated.
The attitude that you're talking about, that a positive attitude will help people get over their diseases and maybe prevent them to begin with, how do you think that works? Is it real? Is there possibility of conscious control of the immune system? That's what it sounds like.
I would say indirectly, yes. It seems pretty clear that...
Secrets of the yogi.
Something like that. I think that we in the Western world tend to have a real dichotomy, a real separation in ourselves between the mind and the body, and I don't think that that's so. And I'm only just beginning to come to this realization, I'll tell you, but it certainly has been made clear recently that people have control over such things as their heartbeat or their body temperature or that kind of thing, things which were formerly believed to be classed under the autonomic nervous system, which by its very name implies that it's not under your control, it's automatic. It seems also to be true that if people can raise their blood pressure or raise their body temperature or so forth, that they can also inhibit certain processes in their body which...
Or activate
certain processes in their body which either help you or hurt you in certain ways. It may well be, for instance, that a person who tends not to take care of themselves through whatever reason may develop an illness, and this may sort of be the body's way or the organism's way to make you stop and take stock of yourself and start taking care of yourself. It's rather a extreme measure, I must say. I will say that I am taking care of myself more now than I ever did before. I just wish I hadn't had such a firm kick in the butt to do it, but I am, and I'm real happy with that.
Activating one's immune system to work with the doctor's drugs to overcome cancer is a long process, but doctors have written before about quote-unquote miraculous remissions and so forth, mm-hmm. that they just simply can't understand. It seems that those are just the power of faith or prayer or whatever has a lot to do with what it does to the attitude of people and a reintegration of quote-unquote mind and body, spirit and flesh, however one wants to do it. Those are only words anyway.
Right. As I say, I'm just starting to come into this. I was up until now quite the empiricist and quite the logical scientist, and I'm just
rational Western man,
and I up until a few months ago really did not put a whole lot of stock into that, and I'm coming around on that. I'm beginning to believe now that having a positive mental attitude is real important. It seems pretty clear that people who feel depressed can get sick, and people who are sick can get depressed, that these things can have a kind of a feedback effect on one another. And now that I am sick and somewhat depressed, I'm trying to break that cycle by raising my own psychological state and also by making myself as healthy as possible outside of the Kapushis. I'm trying to eat better. I'm trying to get more sleep.
And you're doing less of the things that you said you needed a kick in the butt to stop.
That's right.
What are those things? Your own case. We're not talking epidemiology. We're not talking proven causation. We're talking about what don't you do now because you don't think you were taking care of yourself when you were doing them before.
Well, up until a few months ago, I used to do quite a lot of the so-called recreational drugs, including alcohol and marijuana and volatile nitrites. I don't now, for the most part, at all. Up until a few months ago, I used to be quite sexually active and have any number of partners. I was interviewed by the Center for Disease Control's officer in San Francisco, and I figured I'd probably had about 10,000 sexual partners in my 10-year gay history. And she didn't raise an eyebrow. She was just
That's almost three a day.
On a good night. And now I've essentially entered onto a monogamous relationship, which I never would have believed would have been possible. But it's not only it's enjoyable to me, and it's also healthy for me, and I feel good about that.
Dr. Conant before suggested more and more that it's looking as if there may be a virus with a point of contact transmission.
It's my understanding right now is that they do not yet know, and I'm right. looking forward very eagerly for the CDC's report on this. Basically, what is being suggested is what I've done with my own life is to reduce the number of one's sexual partners and to reduce the frequency of use of recreational drugs. It seems like those two things could reduce one's immune status, could make you more susceptible to various illnesses. It's a hard thing to suggest to somebody because they're certainly a lot of fun. And I'm not making any moral judgments about to people. I'm just suggesting that they may be a risk factor. It's like smoking cigarettes. There's a little message written on the pack, you know, and you can decide whether or not smoking is worth the risks that you're taking. You can decide whether sex, drugs, and rock and roll are worth the risks that you're taking. I think that's up to each individual person to decide. I think what we need to know is that there are indeed some risks involved in that, and that was sure brought home to me.
Do you have any message for yourself or a message for people out there that you think need to hear something? Obviously, if they have little reddish spots, reddish to purple spots on their arms and legs or any other part of their body that are flat on the skin, they should go to their doctor.
Right. And furthermore, I think that they should go to a doctor who is familiar with this. As I say, the first doctor I went to had never seen it, but she was smart enough to refer me to someone who did. I think that any sexually active gay man is at risk for this disease, even though it is still pretty rare. It wasn't rare enough when it happened to me. I think that the message I have, first of all, is that we need to start taking care of ourselves and each other. If you think that you may have this illness, what you really need to do is to go see a doctor. If it's proven that you do, I encourage you to contact through the doctors to find other brothers who have this illness so that we can sort of talk to each other and support each other through this.
So you are forming support networks.
That's right.
It's easier to be positive together.
That's certainly true. Basically, the Shanti Project in Berkeley is sponsoring support groups for gay men with Kaposi's as well as any person with a life-threatening illness. Anybody who wants to contact the Shanti Project in Berkeley, their number is 849-4980.
That's 849-4980.
I think the notion of support groups for people who have any particular situation, especially the so-called gay cancer, is real important, and I've gotten a lot of strength from the men that are in this group with me.
Anything you want to add before we close for the evening?
Take care of yourselves, brothers and sisters. You're the only one you've got.
Thanks for being our guest tonight, Bobby Campbell.
Thank you, Andy.
And that about wraps up our discussion of gay cancer tonight. Earlier in the show, you heard Dr. Marcus Conant and Dr. Paul Volberding of the University of California Medical School. The opinions expressed by the guests on The Gay Life are not necessarily those of the producer, KSAN-FM, Malwright Incorporated, advertisers, or employees. Next week on The Gay Life, we'll talk to Dr. Dale McGee and Dr. Robert K. Bolin of the Bay Area Physicians for Human Rights. Dr. McGee is the organization's president, and Dr. Bolin is chair of its task force on nitrite inhalants. Bolin also recently authored a set of guidelines for sexual health. We'll also talk to Dr. Thomas P. Lowry, a psychiatrist who's conducted considerable research on pauper safety. I'm Randy Alford, and I produce The Gay Life. I'm also the editor of The Sentinel, which is available in gay neighborhoods and night spots in San Francisco and the East Bay. The Gay Life would like to hear from you, so write us if you have any comments, criticisms, or suggestions. Our address is The Gay Life, KSAN, 345 Sansom Street, San Francisco, California, 94104-1397. Once more, that's The Gay Life, KSAN, 345 Sansom Street, San Francisco, 94104-1397. Tune in again next Sunday night at 11 o'clock for The Gay Life. Gay nightlife has lured you.